Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power at Grantham University. Now here's your host, Jason Forticola.
Today we'll be joined by Democracy for America Chair Jim Dean, labor author Philip Dre, AFGE TSA local presidents Kim Cranach Lambert and Robert McNeil, and GovLoop Director of Community Engagement Andrew Krasmarczyk. But first, Jim Dean. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So Democracy for America, along with the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, launched a pretty impressive TV ad in support of public workers in Wisconsin. Tell us about the ad.
Well, it's a great ad because it really has, you know, real people in it talking about their real own personal experiences and what they're going to be going through and what they are going through under Governor Walker's sort of one-person rule governorship right now. And it's very effective in that way, and that it communicates those real stories that a lot of other people in Wisconsin can relate to. And we certainly raised a lot of money to keep it on the air, which we're very much doing right now to keep this thing in front of people as much as we can.
Sure. It looks like you all broke $500,000 in fundraising for this ad. Is that right?
Yeah, and so that buys a lot of time in Wisconsin, and which is what we've been doing for the last couple of days.
And now this thing looks like it's gotten some traction, not just in Wisconsin, but you've had some internet presence as well with that. Where else are you airing this ad?
Well, we are airing it buying internet ads because they're pretty effective, and I know Google's got a couple of new products out there that we wanted to try out with this. Again, the importance of this is to get it out as far and wide and to keep this message in front of people. I think it's very clear that Governor Walker picked the wrong state to try sort of one-party dictatorial rule, and we've got to fight back. We got to finish this job. We got to do it for the folks in Wisconsin, but we really got to do it for everybody, all employees, government and private sector, all over this country. And we have a chance to really overturn a lot of the bad stuff that's going on in Ohio and Florida and with Governor Christie in New Jersey. So we're going to keep this ad up as long as we can.
Yeah, you make a great point with that. In fact, we had a guest on last week who talked about this very issue, and he said that this action by the Wisconsin government is not just an attack on unions, but it's really an attack on the entire middle class. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is, in fact, we set up our own website just for the purpose of this ad and sharing information called waronworkingfamilies.com. We did that with the PCCC because this is a war on working families. It is a war in the middle class, and it is a war on all employees. It's really been going on for about 30 years since Reagan came into office, and all of a sudden it became really cool to lay off lots of people. It's what we've seen, of course, recently is that this has migrated over now to, blaming teachers, blaming firefighters, blaming cops for government deficits, for high taxes and that sort of thing. When you're looking at people that are making somewhere between $50,000, $60,000 or even less, $30,000 to $40,000 a year, that's a bit of a stretch, especially when we have a lot of big businesses with chief executive officers getting paid tens of millions of dollars a year. So we think this has been an extension of something that's been going on for a long time. And this ad is an expression of Americans related to other Americans who have gone through this, whether, they work in the government or especially those who have worked in the private sector, most of whom have been laid off at least once in their lives.
Sure. And it seems the conflict then becomes that while some of the teachers and firefighters, like you mentioned, who aren't making very much money are being asked to take a pay cut or a pay freeze or something like that, the other side, who may have a little bit more money, a little bit more wealth, aren't being asked to do very much in return. What are your thoughts on that? And do you agree?
Well, you are absolutely right about that, Jason. A lot of people are talking shared sacrifice. But when it comes to walking the walk, particularly in America's business community, business leadership right now, they're not particularly good at doing that. And, honestly, I think this is a grown-up conversation. I think Americans are prepared to make those sacrifices, but they're not going to make them If people who make over $250,000 a year keep getting bigger tax cuts, if Scott Walker keeps giving away tax cuts to specific industry groups that supported him during his campaign, or passing legislation that's beneficial to his own benefactors, the Koch brothers, this is not working with the voters at large right now. And honestly, you know, I have Republican friends, and they'll talk, well, what are we going to do about Social Security? We're not going to do anything about Social Security or any of these programs, and we're not going to cut any programs until there really is a real shared sacrifice from all segments of the society, rather than just those who don't happen to be out of power at the one particular moment.
Let's go back to the ad for a minute. The ad really goes into the struggle for working men and women. Talk about some of the people in the ad.
Well, you know, these are great folks. And let me tell you something. It's one thing for us to do an ad, Jason. It's another thing for four or five people to get up and stand up for what they believe in publicly in their own backyard. And that's what these folks did in this ad. And I really am very, very grateful to that. And I think it took a lot of guts for them to do that. So I really appreciate it. And, you know, what they're doing, again, is these are folks that aren't really, you know, you're not really in this for the money if you're being a teacher. You're not necessarily in this if you've been working at a job like an electrician or other jobs. You know, there's something more to that than just going to work for 8 hours and getting a paycheck. You know, these folks clearly demonstrate that there's much more commitment in Americans who work for a living and Americans who are middle class, who are making these kinds of salaries. There's much more to that than just simply getting a work and going to work, getting a paycheck and getting a pension. So I think the purpose of these four folks being this is to relate, again, that story that all of us to relate to every day we go to work, and understand that the assault that they're dealing with right now from Governor Walker is something that is all of our problems, and it's something that affects all of us, and that all of us need to be involved to overturn the work that Governor Walker is trying to do right now.
Sure. Public workers like teachers and firefighters, they're in it for something a little more meaningful than just the paycheck, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's called public service. And, you know, I think, you know, we've been hearing this drone from mainstream media for years about how public service employees don't work, you know, are lazy and all this other stuff. And I mean, it's just disgraceful. And it's really demeaning. What Chris Christie is doing right now, talking about teachers, really is just off the wall. You know, these are people that make less than on an average in New Jersey. I think the starting salary is something like $30,000 to $35,000 a year. You know, with seniority, you could make as much as $73,000 a year, but that's only if you've paid to get a master's degree out of your own pocket and done it on your own time. I mean, this is a real commitment. And it's not an easy job. And you just ask Mayor Cory Booker that. You know, he's the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, the tough school system. But these folks go in there every day to try to turn it around. And for Chris Christie, who's their leader, their employer, their chief executive officer, to be up there demeaning the work they do, I think is really disgusting.
Sure. And I'm sure you know this. We're seeing this in the federal sector as well. You know, pay freezes, budget cuts, balancing the budget on the backs of federal employees. It really seems like it's just a popular thing to do these days. What are you doing and Democracy for America doing to sort of push back on that?
Well, certainly the ad is one thing, as you've talked to about Jason. But you know, the other thing that DFA is all about is the field work. You know, we have situations going on, as we've mentioned before, in a lot of different states, and we need to organize around this, and we need to talk to a lot of people on the ground about this. We can't just simply leave it up to have an air ward, or worry about doing ads on TV. We've got to reach out to our family, friends, and neighbors and help them to understand that government employees are there for a reason. They do a good job, that they're committed, and that we, in fact, really need to have them there, and that we should start valuing their work and instead of demeaning it. And that's sort of a long-term, I think, a long-term effort that we all have to undertake in order to change this thing around. I mean, one of the problems with this recession, one of the problems with this economy right now is it is the product of the fact that we've had a few business leaders who have made a ton of money, and they've made a ton of money simply by blaming everything that goes wrong on the employees. And that is a culture that has really set this country back, and we can start right now, particularly with the war on government employees, by talking to our family, friends, and neighbors, by getting out there on some of these campaigns and making our voices heard, so that we can bring back the respect for culture of work.
Sure, Jim. And we're coming down into our last minute here, so I want to get your thoughts on one key issue. If you eliminate or shrink a public workforce, isn't it fair to assume that you'd also be shrinking the amount of services that the public would be getting?
Well, right now, that is one of the biggest problems in getting our economy turned around. You know, we have all of these opportunities ahead of us, and they're being held back by the fact that the governments have been forced to cut back on services. They've been forced to cut back on things like not only educational opportunities, which make our workforce competitive in the global marketplace, critical to our economy, but they're also cutting back on things like transportation infrastructure and public safety in some cases, all of which are critical to our economic turnaround right now. So there has to be a much, much better balance right now, and we need to be hearing a lot more responsible rhetoric from our political leadership on this instead of this sort of one-off, let's lower taxes, lower the deficit, and nobody will get hurt message that they've been sending.
Yeah, I think the diminishing services really gets overlooked a lot of times when people start talking about cutting and saving money and whatnot. Losing the valuable services is very, very important.
Oh, no, you're absolutely correct. I mean, already around here in Connecticut, where I am today, Jason, you know, a lot more people are taking public transportation, which is a good thing. But public transportation, the fares have gone up and the service has been cut. So it's already simply been outstripped of its capacity has been outstripped to serve our economic interests, our economic needs right now. So it's very, very important. That we, you know, that we come back and again deliver that message, so that the taxpayers understand that they really are getting a lot out of this thing, and they really are getting a lot of value, and that we need that value there, and that people who work for a living ought to be able to make a living.
Jim Dean, chair of Democracy for America, as always, Jim. Thanks so much for your time today.
Jason, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Philip Dre, author of There Is Power in a Union, The Epic Story of Labor in America. Philip, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
We want to get your thoughts on the battles in Wisconsin, Indiana, Ohio, and elsewhere in an effort to take away collective bargaining rights from public employees. What do you think about that?
Well, of course, everybody, you know, is right sort of justifiably up in arms about it. There are so many offensive things about it, one hardly knows where to start. Of course, the fact that it's kind of tucked behind this issue of trying to minimize state debt or whatever, you know, it's such a bogus issue because here you've got, of course, a lot of unions are willing and are, in fact, working with government to try to address these financial issues. But, of course, lurking within that, in the Wisconsin thing in particular, there's, you know, not only the thing about collective bargaining and restructuring the way in which union membership is handled and paid for, but also other things about privatizing the state utilities and things like that. So it's really a kind of a whole nefarious sort of package of neoconservatism. And of course, there's a bullseye on labor's back.
Sure, it seems convenient at this time of economic hardship in America to tie the argument to finances and budget deficits. But is there really a connection between workplace protections for employees and budgets bleeding red ink in states around the country?
Well, it's a I think it's kind of a tough argument to make, actually. I mean, I don't think the unions and the wages are what's causing these states their financial problems. I mean, again, I think the unions are willing to work on those fronts. But, you know, basically overall, I sort of see it as a kind of a duplicitous argument because, you know, in other words, is we know a lot of times unions would bargain pensions and retirement, you know, benefits, et cetera, against wages in the near term, and management is more than happy to do that. So then for management to come back a decade later or 20 years later and say, it's, you know, your greed is causing these problems, you know, those were bargained in good faith, and many people, workers, you know, gave up short-term gains in wages with the promise of secure retirement and that sort of thing. So to sort of give it on one hand and use it as a bargaining tool and then come back 20 years later for the state to say, well, you're being selfish, just seems a little disingenuous.
Sure. In your book, There is Power in a Union, you write extensively about concessions that unions have made for companies in the past. But collective bargaining rights doesn't seem to make sense, does it?
Well, it's a very interesting, of course, as you, I'm sure you've seen it too, you know, there have been polls published in the last few days which are very heartening, basically saying that while a lot of Americans still have negative views of unions, they, well, I think something like 60+% support collective bargaining. So, I mean, that's really refreshing to see because it shows that people, just like freedom of speech or something like that, I mean, collective bargaining is not in the Constitution, but maybe it should be. In other words, it's a right that even people who may be antagonistic to unions still recognize and respect.
Sure. It's one thing to give up pay or wages in the short term or to work out a solution for the long-term viability of the company, but asking workers to simply give up their right to collectively bargain or other workplace protections doesn't seem fair.
No, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, I'm grateful, and I think a lot of people are grateful that the majority of Americans seem to recognize that. Which is, you know, again, it's heartening. So I think in that way, labor can be kind of cheered by what's going on right now. It's good to see not only the level of activism, but the fact that there seems to even be a broader faith in collective bargaining among the American people as well.
And this certainly is a defining moment for the labor movement. Obviously, there were a number of defining moments in the past, and there will be in the future. But talk about the impact of this moment and what it means for labor going forward.
Well, of course, it's hard to say, maybe too early, but one thing I can't help compare it to is, of course, what happened in 1981 with President Reagan and the air traffic controllers. I mean, that was maybe one of the last major national labor issues where, you know, labor was sort of caught asleep at the wheel a little bit. And as we all know, PATCO, the air traffic controllers, were fired, you know, and labor took kind of a body blow there because Reagan established I'm not going to say for all time, but at least he established this idea that replacement workers were an okay thing, and that one could just get rid of unions. And so, you know, I think we've been living in the shadow of PATCO ever since. So in a certain way, this, what's happening now with Wisconsin and elsewhere, it's good because you see labor on its feet fighting back. And you know, I don't even know how much of it is strictly organized. There's a lot of just citizens who are outraged as well. So I think it's all very healthy. And, you know, where it'll go exactly, it's hard to say. Obviously, labor still has a lot of problems. It's much diminished from its former stature. But, of course, you can't, you know, we'll sort of take what we can get, I suppose.
Sure. We had a guest on recently, Isaiah Poole from OurFuture.org, and he made a great point and said this isn't just an attack on collective bargaining rights. This is an attack on all of the middle class. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, to me, it is just like, just as we were saying at the top of the interview, you know, this is really like a corporate, neo-corporate agenda, neoconservative agenda, rather, being kind of rolled out. And as the Wisconsin bill kind of shows, it's all between privatization and also this business of going after the union's organizing rights and bargaining rights. It's definitely an assault. It's like it's an assault on civil rights, really, in a way. In the middle class, you're absolutely right to make that point.
And it seems like your earlier assessment that people really are on the side of the unions and the workers on this. The Washington Post recently issued the results of a national poll that said most people back government workers and unions. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I saw the same poll. It is very heartening. I think a lot of the sort of quote-unquote problem with public service employees that you often hear about, you know, a lot of it is kind of ginned up by the conservatives. I think, a lot of Americans don't necessarily mind the fact that employees of any stripe are unionized. I think most people recognize that even if you're not in a union yourself, if you're a worker, you probably are the beneficiary of what the unions do. And I think that's a very healthy thing. So I'm not surprised in a way by the results of those polls.
Explain to us a little bit about how this situation ties into some of the content matter in your book, There Is Power in a Union. You detail a number of key points in labor's history. How does this struggle for collective bargaining rights in the public sector fit into that?
Well, of course, in a way, it's collective bargaining was something that was, along with a lot of the other reforms of the New Deal, which was when collective bargaining was guaranteed. Those were hard fought for by unions for many, many years. You can go back to the late 19th century, Coxey's Army, the Pullman strike, what have you, and basically, labor was sort of asking for these things, not only some form of some kind of rational bargaining, but also the broader sort of social safety net of unemployment insurance and Social Security reforms that came with the New Deal. So in a certain way, I see collective bargaining as a sort of germinal part of what organized labor has always in this country sort of been after, even if the term didn't really come into popular usage until the early 20th century, in the era of what they called industrial democracy, the kind of progressive movement for a kind of more rational approach to industrial labor relations. The late 19th century was a very violent period, and there was a concerted effort by people like Louis Brandeis and others to bring things to a more rational head, and collective bargaining was one of the fruits of that effort.
How do you see this situation in Wisconsin and elsewhere shaking out in the end?
Very good question. I suppose in the near term, it has to do with some of these, what the majorities in these state legislatures are. The Wisconsin thing seems like it may very well be stalemated just because you have the Democrats. There are enough Democrats who are willing to kind of stand up to it, and of course the huge public disapproval as well. I'm not exactly sure how it'll play out in Ohio and Indiana. I don't think the majorities there are as firm. So one never knows, and I don't want to make it sound too rosy. On the other hand, given the uproar that's been created, it's sort of, I've got my fingers crossed. It's hard to picture these things just sailing through as their sponsors apparently thought they would.
Do you see similarities in this situation, comparing it to what's happening in the Middle East, where people are standing up and saying, we're not going to take this any longer. We are going to keep what's ours. We're going to protect our rights. We're not going to let people take it away from us.
I mean, it's funny because a lot of people, of course, there's been these reports of, Cairo sending goodwill messages to Madison, Wisconsin, which is wonderful. I don't know whether it's, sunspots or probably more likely. I think at least I can't speak too much about the Middle East, but at least in America, I think for a long time now, since the financial crisis of, late 2008, at least, people have been saying, like, where are the people? Where is the response? In the early days of the Depression, you saw, unemployed people joining with workers, marching, protesting, taking over relief offices, a lot of activism. And I think people wondered this time around, like, where is the outrage? And so I think this is it. You push too far, and, you know, you can pull a lot of monkey shines, but when you start tampering with something as fundamental as collective bargaining, you hit a nerve. And people get fed up, and they're just like, enough already. We're not going to take this one. So I do think there's something going on. And, yeah, it's similar, of course, in the Middle East. Their problems are, in a way, so much more immense in that they're trying to shake off these authoritarian governments that have been in power for decades, and it's a denial of all kinds of basic human rights. So that's something different. But whether there's a connection, I don't know, but it's, in any case, very encouraging on both sides.
And talk about how important it is for labor, really, in this situation in Wisconsin and elsewhere, to dig its heels in and stand its ground and make sure that these workers keep these collective bargaining rights and these workplace protections.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely do or die, to be honest. You know, and I hope, I don't know exactly what form the argument will take. I don't know enough about it to say for sure. Maybe it could even move into the courts. I don't know for sure. But obviously, I think it's something that everybody recognizes is it's sort of a line in the sand, and it's something really worth fighting for. Let's face it, it really couldn't be more important in a way. I mean, collective bargaining is such an essential right. You know, I think without it, I don't know what you would see. You would go back to an earlier phase of labor strife in the 19th century where unions did not have any kind of sanctioning for collective bargaining from the government. And you saw a lot of just sort of, you know, wildcat strikes, violent work stoppages, fighting between company thugs and workers and soldiers and all sorts of stuff, and the use of the, you know, court injunctions against labor unions. It was a very violent, sort of unproductive time in a way, because, and I think that's what, you know, eventually capital realized that. That's why you had when you flash forward to the 30s, that's why you see big, like, the, you know, General Motors, U.S. Steel, sort of capitulating to collective bargaining, because they realized it was in their interest, too, to work things through in a rational way, that these, you know, violent confrontations really serve nobody in the end. And so, one can only hope that cooler heads will prevail, as they say.
Sure. Coming down into our last minute here, Phil, what are your last thoughts?
Well, like I said, I think that it's something that, it's a very heartening protest. It's always good to see when you see this kind of organic outbreak, really, of protest. I think a lot of no one could have necessarily predicted it. And I think a lot of people on the other side, the right, you know, they thought it was just going to sort of they were just going to pass this through. And so it's good to see resistance. And I could only hope that it will be successful. And, of course, the best result would be that it would also catalyze the labor movement overall, give it a sense of a new sense of confidence in all its other areas in which it's engaged in terms of membership growth and also its outreach on the global sphere, which, of course, is very important now. You know, that's kind of a new front for labor, trying to reach out to global partners, human rights advocates, anti-sweatshop leagues. We see that going on. You know, personally, I believe labor unionization is a kind of universal and renewable force. You see it at auto plants in China, in Honduras, textile factories in Mexico. It's something that, you know, workers will only put up with so much, and eventually they will turn to the collective might of their own strength, essentially. And so one thinks that maybe workers everywhere can draw some inspiration from this.
Philip Dre, author of There Is Power in a Union, The Epic Story of Labor in America. As always, Philip, thank you for your time and your expertise on this.
Thanks for having me. Take care, Jason.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government. But listen to our members, the real people, who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Kim Cranach-Lambert and Robert McNeil, two TSA local presidents. Kim, of course, from Local 332, and Robert from Local 237 in Providence, Rhode Island. Both of you, welcome to the program. So this is a very exciting time for TSOs with the granting of collective bargaining rights. Tell us a little bit about that.
I'm excited that after 8 years, we got limited collective bargaining, but I think we'll fight until we get full collective bargaining rights.
I agree with Kim. It's been a long struggle for us to get these rights after 8 years, but the fight's just beginning now. It's just the beginning to where we need to go to get full collective bargaining rights.
And what's next? I mean, you both indicated that it's just sort of the beginning, just a first step. What's coming next?
We have an election coming up for union representation, and AFGE was behind that, and the only reason why we're having an election is because of AFGE.
Yes, the local election, the national election is next, and that'll start in approximately 6 weeks. And like Kim said, that is all because of AFGE. The AFGE took the forethought to file the petition last year to get that step out of the way already. So now, right now, we're just trying to get people mobilized and out to get out the vote.
Talk about in your respective airports, of course, Kim, you're in Pittsburgh, and Robert, you're in Providence, some of the challenges that you face as TSOs and how the granting of collective bargaining rights will make your workplace better.
I think in Pittsburgh, as I said, we've been fighting for 8 years, and I believe our membership's going to improve because we will have some collective bargaining. I think our people see that AFGE did that. They also see that AFG's been there for 8 years. They never left us. I never left them. I'm fortunate and happy and proud that I've been fighting this fight for 8 years, and I'm so grateful to AFGE and everything that everybody's done for us.
Well, some of the things that I could see happening is the first thing is the TSOs actually having a voice at the table. Something that TSA's never given us. They have take it or leave it policies. Now that we're going to have the right to collect and bargain, we will have a voice in our workplace.
And how important is that? What will that do for the morale of the agency?
Well, right now, TSA is ranked in the bottom 5% of agencies to work at, like 240 out of 244. Giving us a voice in what we're going to be in our working conditions is going to change the morale. It's going to give people more opportunities for fair scheduling, fair assignments, and things of that sort.
And what are you faced with now? I know, obviously, we're just at the beginning of 2011, but at the end of 2010, TSA was in the headlines. It was on television, of course, around the holidays and the scanning procedures that were in place. How did that impact you as workers?
I think it was I think it's awful the way that happened, and that a few people had 15 minutes of fame and blew everything out of proportion. And I commend our administrator for going out and doing a media blitz, defending his workers, because for 8 years we've had nobody defend us besides AFGE. And I have to tell you that I think that helped the morale, that we had some support from our administrator, plus always AFGE. And people need to realize that threat that we have, that we face every day, is real. And that what we do is important, and we're protecting the flying public.
Right. You know, like Kim says, our administrator stood behind us with everything with that, because it was a new thing that was coming, new procedures that were coming out. And he stood by us 100% for our safety, for our welfare. And that's something that we were glad to see from an administrator in this agency.
Take us through what was going through your mind when you learned that administrator was now granting you collective bargaining rights, something that you have been fighting for almost a decade.
I think that when he did that, I think for the first 6 months of his new job, he was talking to people. I actually got to personally talk to him when he was in Pittsburgh. He was on the job for 3 weeks. He asked my opinion. I think for the first time in almost a decade, people were listening to us, and they care about what we want. And I believe that he thinks that giving us a voice in work will improve morale, it will improve security, and our overall mission. So I think it's going to be a win-win for everybody.
Yes, when the administrator made the announcement on Friday, we were happy that we have that decision now, because he did take the time to look at everything through the whole picture. It took him 8 months to do it, but he came out with it, and that's great for us, because, you know, we don't want to have to think about anything but what we're doing at work and have any concerns about the conditions of our work. With this decision, I think that he knows it's going to improve morale throughout the agency, and I truly believe that this administrator is very motivated about that.
As local presidents, have you been able to reach out to or speak to your members since the announcement was made? And if so, what was their reaction?
When we flew out, we got to talk, and everybody was kind of applauding and thanking us and go get them in D.C., and they're proud of us, and they know who's done that, and they know AFG has done that, and I think things are just going to get better. I think we're looking ahead, and things are just going to be great. They're not going to be perfect, but it's a start, and we're going to work from what we have.
The members that I've gotten to have gotten to speak to since the decision was, you know, they're very happy the decision was made, because the way that they're looking at it is we're better off today than we were yesterday. Everything, they know it's going to come incrementally, and it's just going to be a process for them. But they're ecstatic that we have an administrator that does care about us.
And, of course, now, this week, you're in D.C., where you all take to Capitol Hill and voice your concerns to your members of Congress. What are your plans for the week?
We still have to try to get this taken out of the ATSA to where this is permanent. You know, it can't change with administrators. So that's one of our messages we have to bring up to the Hill every time we go up there.
Is that because future administrations could change what Mr. Pistol has decided?
Future administrations can change it, and that's why we need that footnote taken out of the ATSA.
We're going to fight for us, as Rob said, and we're also going to fight for all federal employees, and that I think it's insulting that Congress or anybody that's talking about rhetoric about federal employees making too much money, because they're not thinking about the front line of Homeland Security or the VA nurses or anybody like that that they're struggling. And it's not fair that the federal employees have to pay the cost because of all the other things that are going on in this country. I think it's appalling.
Speaking of rhetoric, you hear a lot of that when things like the budget comes up or how much federal employees are paid, oftentimes making apples to oranges comparisons. What do you think the appropriate course of action is in dealing with these sorts of issues, and maybe some alternatives to balancing the budget on the backs of the federal employees?
I think it needs to start with some common sense, and I think that you don't go after the people that are protecting your borders and your airports and your food and all the civil servants and the federal employees' jobs that they do. Federal employees don't make $100,000, $200,000 a year. They're making $30,000, $40,000, and they're struggling. And I think it's insulting.
And you're saying that, of course, making $30,000 or $40,000 a year, a two-year pay freeze has an impact, a real impact on people. When healthcare costs are going up, the prices of food and gas and medical care, your insurance premiums as a federal employee are going up, those things have consequences when you don't have an increase every year to offset some of that. Is that right?
That's correct. My healthcare goes up 7%. I don't get a raise. So actually, I'm taking home less money now without a raise, and it's just going to keep getting worse and worse for the amount of time that they keep this freeze in effect for. The federal employees, the working people of the government, the civil servants, as Kim said, we do not make $100,000. We do not make $200,000. We make $30,000, $40,000. We're trying to stretch that as much as we can, and now they're going to increase our parking, increase our health care, but not increase our pay.
I talked to a couple of congressmen in the airport, and I asked them about what they thought about the federal freeze. I didn't like the comments that they made that everybody has to do their share, which we do. But I really wanted to tell them, how about you start paying for your health insurance? Because us as federal employees pay for our health insurance, and as he says, it goes up every year, and we make less money. I wonder how much the government would save if our congressmen and senators pay for their own health insurance to start. I think that would be a good start right there.
I think a lot of people are asking the same questions you are. Coming into our last minute, we'll give you the last word.
I just want to thank everybody at AFG, and I'm so proud to be an AFG member, and I work for TSA, and I'm proud of that, and I just want to say thank you.
Yes, I also want to thank everybody at AFG, from the national vice presidents to the organizers, everyone who's making this possible for us. 9 years ago, we never thought it would happen, and we're almost there.
And AFGE certainly thanks you for your commitment and your loyalty to your fellow workers and to the union, of course. We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Andy Krizmarzik, the Director of Community Engagement for GovLoop. Andy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on the show, Tiffany.
Why don't you give us an update on what's happening at GovLoop these days?
Well, we just crossed a significant milestone. We, in February, reached 40,000 members, and already here in almost mid-March, we're at 41,500. So we just keep growing and adding more smart people to the mix. In terms of just some of the content and initiatives, the most popular topics right now are the pay freeze, what's going on with unions in Wisconsin and elsewhere, government reorganization, and then the budget battle that's brewing, and will government shut down? So those are just four of the hot pieces of content right now.
And what are people saying on GovLoop about the attack on public workers in Wisconsin and elsewhere?
Yeah, I think most people feel like they're standing in solidarity. They understand why unions were created. And by the way, I want to note that the most of the people that have responded to these forums are not in unions. They're government colleagues who are standing shoulder to shoulder with these people in the workplace. And they're saying, look, I get it. I understand why unions are important, so that people can organize around, foreign issues so they don't get taken advantage of by management. But at the same time, everybody's being asked to sacrifice in this environment. And so some people understand that they're going to need to be some changes, especially as boomers are slated to retire and just the deficit that we're looking at as a nation. So mixed, but generally people support what's happening with unions.
Sure. I'd imagine that at a time like this that public workers would all be standing together in an effort to, sort of keep what they have. And like you said, the members on GovLoop are 41,000 plus strong of really smart, intelligent people who get it, right?
Yes. As you might see on other places on the web, I won't name, specific places. We've all been there, major media sites, it devolves into, ad hominem attacks and partisan bickering. And that's not what's happening on GovLoop. I call it the miracle of GovLoop, actually, is people really engage in a thoughtful way, and they're really seeking solutions to these tough challenges. I wish we could create mini guides or reports, and we are to some degree, but just really kind of bottle up that energy and the ideas that are being shared. And share them with some of the executives that are making these decisions that aren't necessarily benefiting government workers.
What are some of those ideas that have come up over things like a potential government shutdown or pay freezes or budget restraints?
Well, I think with the technology that we have today, including places like GovLoop, people are saying, why isn't there more of a crowdsourcing effort around this? We have Governor Perdue here in North Carolina who basically put the budget up there and said, hey, look, these are the tough decisions I'm having to make citizens. You recalibrate the budget, you see what a tough time I'm having. Or why not do that with government workers? Why not have some type of ideation platform, a crowdsourcing platform where people can come up with their own ideas for budget cuts or budget shifts in a way that's much more participatory rather than top-down? So I think that's the main thrust, I think, behind what people are suggesting is that this could be much more based on, the average person who's going to be impacted by the changes.
Let's talk a little bit about what GovLoop has to offer. What are some things that you're working on right now or some recent initiatives?
Well, I think my favorite two are really around jobs. I mean, I think we know that there are going to be likely furloughs and people are going to be losing their jobs with budget cuts. So we've been ramping up as fast as we can around something we're calling Gov Gigs. Overall, that's going to include hopefully some, mentor programs. But things that we already have in place are a group called Rock Your Resume. It's got 300 folks, and what they're doing is people are submitting their resume and getting those reviewed by their peers and or experts in resume writing. We hosted a webinar in tandem with the Partnership for Public Service a couple of Fridays ago, and that was recorded and archived, and that's located in the group. And we're going to do more webinars, and we're really just going to keep building out that particular resource. We also have taken some of the content on usajobs.gov, and we've repurposed it into infographs to make it easier to read. We rolled out the first one last week. I'm rolling out another one today, and then the third one will be posted next week, and that includes interviewing skills and resume writing.
So it sounds like you all have a lot to offer. Why do you think GovLoop has taken off and had so much success?
Well, where was there before where a person could be sitting at their desk and have a question and turn to something that's essentially like, Google for Gov or, LinkedIn for government? I have a question. I can basically go there and GovLoop it. Right? I can ask my question in a forum. I can search the blogs and see if somebody has written about this, either one of my peers or an expert. Or I can join a group of like-minded folks. In fact, we have a group for AFGE on GovLoop. It's govloop.com/group/AFGE. And just join with other people, ask my questions, get them answered in virtually real time. I think that's the real secret, and it's not just federal, but it's people who are doing similar things at state and local. So really just bridging gaps in ways that were never before possible.
So it's almost like a public worker goes into their office, they get set up for the day, they log on to GovLoop, and it's like a real-time help desk on all things government-related.
That's how we're hoping people see it. We'd love GovLoop to be a verb, you know, just like Google is, you know, when somebody has a question, oh, I'm going to Google that. We hope that government employees think of GovLoop that way, and I'm going to go GovLoop that. And that I know within an hour or two, I'm going to get two or three responses at least from people doing similar stuff as me, and, you know, that's going to be useful. Whether that's insight or real-time resources, you know, a template for some policy I'm writing or, you know, some tips on, you know, writing skills or whatever it might be, that you have resources at your fingertips in the form of people, not just information.
Talk about the need for real solid public service in today's world.
You know, I think public service gets a bad rap. I mean, we're seeing it. I mean, the media just tears up public servants. They're easy targets. But what I've found from GovLoop and from being a public servant myself, essentially, while working at the graduate school USDA, which is, it was formerly part of USDA serving government. But what I've found is people in public service are sincerely interested in being good stewards of taxpayer dollars. They are taxpayers themselves. Why would they get up every morning and waste their own money, right? And I think we need to have this public shift in perception. And I think that happens through better marketing of what government does, but I think also through initiatives like telework that put people back in the neighborhoods, back in the communities, so that they can interact with their neighbors and people can see, oh, you know, that's my friend, that's my fellow person who goes to church with me, they're a government employee, and I know them, and I know that they have my best interest and the public's best interest at heart. I think that's what's going to start to move the chain in that regard.
Yeah, it seems like when you talk to someone about government service and break down almost agency by agency, job by job, that's when you really start to see that you can make an impact on someone's perception of government. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, well, and we see that on a daily basis. I mean, these are, you know, government employees who, you know, people get to know in a more personal way. They get to know each other. But I would love for citizens to start really taking a look at what's happening in a place like GovLoop, the sincere conversations to try to strengthen and improve government. I think that would help, too. So right now, it's largely government employees and private contractors, academics, nonprofit associations, but I'd love for citizens to start taking a peek too, you know, and realize that these are real people who really want to make a difference.
Sure. I imagine one way that you're able to connect with the public like that is through some of your charitable causes, which I know is important to GovLoop. Could you tell us about some of that?
Yeah, one thing we did was we worked with Dreams for Kids last year, and we teamed up with them, and we had them go to Metro stops and just have a clipboard in hand and sign people up to join GovLoop. But also, then in the process, we ended up giving them a donation. We also, I can't remember the name of the organization that we partnered with, forgive me, to that organization, but we essentially also created a scholarship program. I think it was Campus Gov, actually, was the name of the organization. And so we gave away a scholarship based on an application. You know, students currently in college could submit an app, and then we had had folks just basically vote on their favorite application.
And as we close out the interview here, Andy, if people want to learn more about GovLoop, how can they find you online?
Well, we're at www.govloop.com. That's a great place to start on our homepage there. And then find me, Andrew Krzmarzik, last name Krzmarzik. Friend me, and I will help you to navigate to the information and the people that will help you do your job better.
Andrew Krzmarzik, Director of Community Engagement for GovLoop. Thanks so much for your time today. Thank you to our guests this week, Democracy for America Chair Jim Dean, Labor author Philip Dre, AFGE TSA Local Presidents Kim Cranach-Lambert and Robert McNeil, and GovLoop Director of Community Engagement Andrew Krzmarzik. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University.